A 15-year-old girl is missing from her family home. Has she run away or has she been abducted by a stranger? What evidence is there? Who's responsible and can science prove it?
A crime scene is a puzzle that has to be solved. A whodunit? A scattering of clues to be deciphered by clever detective work and the power of science.
The Friday night before Marie went missing, she was at a good friend's place where she stayed the night, and she went back to her own home on the Saturday afternoon. And she was dropped off by her friend and her friend's mother. And that is the last physical sighting we had of Marie and confirmed.
6 p.m. on Saturday evening, and 15-year-old Marie Davis is home alone in the Christchurch suburb of Papanui. Her mother's been out of town visiting relatives, a first trip away from her two daughters. And tonight, Marie's older sister, Amy, has also gone out. Marie has a close friend living nearby, and she's in contact with her sister.
So there were no issues with Marie being there, and everyone was aware that Marie was home alone.
Marie didn't go to parties. She was nearly 16, but no, I don't think she ever went to a party, actually, that I know of. She would have been on the computer with music going or reading a book. And she wanted to clean up to make sure it was all nice for me when I'm coming back. And she never stayed at home ever on her own. So she would just thought, oh, this is neat. Do what I want to do, and got all the time to do it. Yeah.
Janet Davis was due to fly in the next morning, Sunday. The arrangement was for older sister Amy to meet Marie at home at 8 o'clock before they went out to welcome back Mum. But when Amy arrived, the door was locked, the curtains and windows closed, and there was no sign of Marie.
The house was locked and secured, as though Marie had gone away and left the house tidy and clean.
Amy tried phoning her sister Marie, but there was no answer. She tried Marie's friends, who didn't know where she was. Marie never came home or answered her phone.
I flew back, and Amy was at the airport, and the mother of Marie's close friend. I thought, oh, Amy's crying. And for a minute, I thought, oh, she was homesick for me, because I'd never been away before without the girls. And she told me that she was missing, and they had no idea where she was. So, yeah, it was a nightmare.
Missing people are reported to the police every day and quite regularly, and the majority are able to be contacted relatively quickly, particularly these days with cell phones and the lights.
But Marie's disappearance struck Virginia LaBar as unusual right from the start.
She had never been missing before for any period of time, and her mother and her sister were very close. Marie's father died when she was three, so they're a very close-knit family, and Marie had very close friends. And for her not to be in contact with them was significant. We went in with some of the staff. I mean, they had a good look round to find out if there was perhaps a note that had been left to say, you know, I've gone somewhere.
Police also looked for any sign of forced entry or disturbance. There was none. But several items of interest were missing.
There were some bedding items that were missing. And most importantly, Marie's wallet, Marie's phone, and the keys to the house.
She had a green satchel bag type thing, and she always had her phone in it and a little bit of makeup. She just never went anywhere without it. And that was gone.
And it did appear, well, perhaps she's just gone off somewhere. So the next morning after we established that, there wasn't anything highly significant in the house, it was really just going and establishing the facts around Marie. So talking to some more of her friends, talking to the school. She enjoyed going to school and had very good friends there. She was very much into her art and music.
She was quiet. She was quiet and reserved. She loved drawing and she was really good at it. She would just spend hours and hours with a sketchbook. Really talented at artwork.
It really was just unexplained. There was nothing in her background to think that she would have run away or that she was unhappy.
Police went door to door asking if anyone had seen her that Saturday night.
What we call an area canvas. So all the neighbours were spoken to and most people in that area knew Marie. There was nothing that came out or anything that was untoward at all. She didn't have access to a car and unlikely to have caught a bus, but of course we do CCTV footage and look at those types of things. And in the early parts of the investigation, there were a lot of blanks. It just continually was blank, blank.
Where was Marie? Why didn't she answer her phone? How could a 15-year-old just disappear?
It was a mystery.
I became involved in the investigation a couple of days in. I took on the role of analysing all the phone data. We would look at her phone just to see if she'd been texting any friends, telling them where she might be going or who she might be going with. On the Saturday night, it showed that Marie was at home. She had very minimal traffic on her cell phone that night, just really texting one of her really close friends.
Data showed Marie texted her friend at 8:20 p.m., then didn't use her phone for the rest of the night.
The next activity on Marie's phone was Sunday morning about 8:15, and that's when she received a text message from one of her sister's friends. About 7 minutes later, Marie received a phone call on her phone.
Marie didn't respond to the text or answer the call, which was strange.
What was of interest was that the text message at 8:15 was polling in the Belfast area, which is just north of Christchurch, and 7 minutes later, when her phone was rung, she was polling in the Kaiapoi area, which is even further north of Christchurch. So she was clearly travelling, or her phone, at least, was travelling in a northerly direction out of Christchurch.
That was the first time we had anything of hers that took us away from her home address. Part of the inquiry then was that where in that area could she be, either voluntarily or had been taken there. So the SAR search team were deployed into that area.
We based the search from here, the Kāinga Hall.
Calculations based on the locations of cell phone towers focus search and rescue teams on Stewart's Gully, an area near Kāinga, about a 20-minute drive north of Marie's home on the edge of the Waimakariri River.
There was some linen property that was missing from her home, some bedding material. So we had a list of that with the patterns on that. And also we had a good description of the clothing that she was probably wearing.
An extensive search began for Marie or any items that could be linked to her.
For the Sunday, we had six teams in the field of three people, so that's 18 of them. Also, we had three dog handlers with another person assisting them. So we had about 24 people in the field on that first day. It's a massive area. It's all rural. It's plantation or scrub or bush.
Almost seems like a little bit of the needle in the haystack. If you don't start looking, you're not going to find anything.
5 days have passed, and there is still no sign of 15-year-old schoolgirl Marie Davis. Searchers are combing a massive land area close to the Waimakariri River, a location determined from her cell phone data. Officers continue to look for other leads.
As the time went on, it just became quite disturbing. We just could not make contact with her.
The longer Marie is not found, the greater fears grow. Investigators call in forensic scientists to examine the family home.
Ideally, we'd like a nice fresh crime scene where there's been no disturbance post-event. But obviously there's been several days, people have been in and out of the house. So there's certain types of evidence, such as, say, footwear analysis, which aren't really going to be viable.
Gary Gillespie demonstrates what's involved at a crime scene examination. Full body suits, gloves and booties stop contamination from hairs, clothing fibres or fingerprints. They have to be worn by everyone before crossing the demarcation line into the hot zone.
So we're ready, Gary, to go into the hot zone now?
Yes, indeed, protected from head to foot and ready to go.
Simply talking while not wearing a face mask could leave our DNA. For demonstration purposes, we're able to remove our masks.
So what was the situation at the Davis house?
When you've got a sort of missing person, the things you may be looking for, is there evidence of an assault? Blood would be the first thing we tend to look for. We'll work our way through room for room with a bright light. It's a visual examination, and a bright light illuminates the scene and really helps us visualise any bloodstaining.
That is a bright light, isn't it? How bright is that?
It's a 1,000-watt light. And have a sort of a scan down here.
And that looks like something there, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much so. It's sort of a nice red-brown stain, pretty typical of what I'd expect for bloodstaining. To me, that looks what we call it a transfer stain. That's right, exactly. So where you've got blood on a surface and you smear it or transfer it onto another surface. Blood staining, I'd be interested in sort of doing chemical tests on that. So we'll just move across a while onto the carpet. And you can just see a couple of small stains on the carpet. To me, they look like what I would call them drip stains. So imagine somebody with a bleeding injury or even blood dripping from a blood-stained object.
So what do you do next?
We need to do sort of a chemical test just to sort of confirm that they are indeed blood. So if you just want to hold the light a minute here, Simon. Okay, what we'll look to do is to rub the stain with the test strip and then just drop a couple of drops of water onto the test strip and you'll see it come a nice green colour. Mm. What that indicates is we've got blood present.
So you know it's blood?
We know it's blood. So what we'll do is we'll put an arrow next to it, get it photographed for continuity purposes, then we'll look to sample it and then we can use that sample for DNA purposes.
At the Davis home, forensic examination revealed two potential sources of evidence.
Marie's bedroom found two small areas of blood staining in one corner of the room, which is sort of furthest from the door. A chemical test indicated it was blood. They were quite small, only several millimetres in size on the floor, but they were evident.
The second area was in the study, a small room off the lounge.
It had a computer in it and there was an upholstered chair, and we did notice some blood staining both on the floor, close to the chair, and also on the back of the chair in one corner and on one of the arms of the chair. The blood staining on the back of the chair was probably a reasonable size, quite light in colour, maybe sort of 20 to 30 millimetres in sort of overall dimension. Blood stains on the armchair were small, then sort of 5 to 6 millimetres, and the one on the floor was sort of quite light in colour, quite close to the colour of the timber. I think it would be difficult to observe without a bright light. In a small room with not much lighting, you may not be able to visually observe it. There was only blood within the study and some small blood stains in Maria's room. That was all we found.
The forensic examination of Marie's house didn't come up with a lot, but it did appear significant, and we knew Marie spent quite a lot of time in the study. There was no other blood in the house that suggested there had been someone that had a bleed. So although there wasn't a lot, it did seem unusual that there were these couple of spots of blood.
Investigators had to consider the possibility of sexual attack. The forensic team were tasked with screening the house for semen, but unlike blood, semen is not visible.
The way we look for semen is we're looking for an enzyme. The enzyme that is present in semen is acid phosphatase. That's present in high quantities in semen.
The process of detection begins by spraying the area with water, then damp paper is applied to draw out any enzymes. The test area is marked out before the paper is removed and painted with a chemical reagent.
Looks like it's starting to discolour here a bit, doesn't
it? Yeah, you can see now we're getting this purple coloration. We leave it up to 2 minutes normally, but you can see now that's probably within sort of 15, 20 seconds. It's quite a quick reaction.
The discoloured area is marked and placed back to identify the suspect zone, which would then be sampled for analysis.
And what did you find?
We didn't find any semen present on any of the floor areas within the house.
The investigation now focuses on the study. The computer, often used by Marie to upload photographs and listen to music, is forensically examined. Marie was most likely using it during her last hours at home.
Marie was working on the computer until around just after 3 o'clock, when there was a song that was loaded on. That song played for 238 times without any more interaction by anyone on that computer. Until approximately 6:30 a.m. that morning, when there was an attempt to close down the computer. And normally the computer has never closed down. We could tell from the forensic examination of the computer that that was an unusual thing to happen for that computer, that the family wouldn't normally leave the computer running.
It raised the obvious question, was someone else in the house? 15-year-old Marie Davis has been missing from her Christchurch home for more than a week. As well as the police investigation, friends and extended family are doing what they can to find her.
She was a very loved girl, so they started producing posters and actively going out looking for her.
Appeals were made through the media for sightings of her or the missing items.
The profile of Marie was high, in the fact that she was a 15-year-old girl and at home alone on a Saturday night, and it had effectively vanished.
It was a mystery that investigators needed to solve. Further phone data was analysed, including landline calls in and out of the Davis home on the Saturday night.
There was a phone call that came into her house about 10 past 8 that night. That phone call lasted about 46 seconds, so it was relatively short.
The phone call had come from the home of Marie's close friend where she'd stayed the previous night. To investigators, it stood out.
It was a hard line, which is most of the young 15-year-olds are using text. So it seemed very unusual as to what that phone call would be about.
After speaking to the people from the address, it became apparent that Marie's friend and Marie's friend's mother, who lived at that address, were both at a barbecue that evening.
And other than that, who lived at the address was the uncle of Marie's friend. So we then spoke to the uncle, and he provided a statement to the police. The uncle explained that he was out with friends that evening, and he hadn't made that phone call. So it was who made that phone call, and what was that about?
With media and public interest running high, police were fielding hundreds of calls, all potential leads or further information.
Sitting late in the evening in the police station and received a phone call from a gentleman who had talked about his sons having been down the Waimakariri River earlier that day and had been out on trail bikes, and they had noticed something in the river which he described as perhaps some bedding, and they had poked and prodded it. And they'd seen his daughter had seen the news that night of where Marie was missing.
The sighting was at an area some 9 kilometres upstream from the original search site.
There's often things that are dumped in these sort of isolated locations. But because we had been searching in that area and we knew that was a likely area that Marie might have been in, that seemed promising.
It was a pretty cold night and the river was up a little bit more than normal, what it normally is, so the river flow was quite swift. When we got up there, the informant indicated where the linen was. I went out and had a look at it and pulled 2 sheets that were snagged against a log. So I removed them and handed them back to the detectives. Then when I was there, I had a look in the water. I could see something turquoise coloured in the water. So I reached down and picked it up. I wasn't sure what it was at that stage, but it was appeared to be snagged. So I grabbed the other end of it with my other hand and pulled it free. When I pulled it out, I could see it was a bra. So I headed that back as well. I could see under the water a brown sheet sort of flaying in the water. It was quite stuck, so what I did was just tied that off to a rock on the side of the bank.
He retrieved all he could in the dark, and the dive squad was called in to search the area once it was daylight.
recovered the blanket that I'd tied off, they had a couple of big boulders dropped on top of it, so it was going to be really difficult for us to try and remove that. They recovered a wallet in the water, her wallet. They retrieved some lengths of rope as well.
In all, 15 items of interest were found. Some of the bedding, the bra and wallet were identified as Marie's.
That was a turning point, to say that that had to be part of what had happened to her, you know, somewhere around that river. So we deployed even more staff out there in that area in the hope that we could locate Marie's, what we believe would be a body.
All the material submitted was very damp, and really prior to examination you've got to dry it and then sample it and examine it from there on in. Any item that has been submerged for a long period of time in water is going to lose a lot of evidential value. Any sort of trace DNA material is going to be lost. The possibility of doing semen analysis is not viable. Any bloodstain may be diluted. So the examination of the items in the river, we had to bear that in mind. Within the bedding, we find a couple of small bloodstains, which we sampled and sent off for DNA analysis. We also recovered hairs. Could they be Marie's hair? Or could we do DNA analysis on them to establish who may they have come from? There was also a couple of items of yellow rope that were recovered. And within one of those items of rope, there was a small section of what looked like a disposable glove attached to it as well. We actually sort of undid the knot, undid DNA swabbing of the material underneath the knot, just in case the area of rope under the knot had been preserved to such an extent that we may have been able to recover DNA, skin cells, etc., that may have been sort of deposited on it from handling an item.
No DNA could be found on the rope samples or the bloodstains. But after extensive analysis, two hairs were linked to Marie Davis. Examining the bra also appeared to confirm the investigators' worst fears.
The hook on the clasp had been quite severely bent back, which is indicative that some force may have been pulled on the bra while it was still being worn or while the clasp was still attached.
Police needed to determine who had made the last landline call to Marie from her friend's house. Everyone who lived there claimed to be out, but someone had to have made that call.
There was a consideration, you know, would someone break into the house and make a phone call? But that really was starting to be a bit ridiculous. During an inquiry like this, we're looking at various people of options, and the phone call that came in that night did heighten our awareness around the uncle.
The uncle, Dean Cameron, claimed to be out with friends.
So we looked at his phone data as to where he may have been in and around on that Saturday, and most in particularly Sunday morning.
Once we got Mr. Cameron's phone data, it became apparent that he'd been travelling around Christchurch City earlier in the evening, sort of from 4 o'clock in the afternoon through to about 6 o'clock with friends. On the Saturday night, Mr. Cameron started receiving phone calls on his cell phone from his friends that he'd been associating with earlier in the evening. That was about just after 10 past eight in the evening, which gives an indication that he wasn't with his friends, and otherwise they wouldn't be calling him. At that time, around about 10 past eight, when he was receiving those phone calls on his cell phone, he was polling in the cell tower closest to his home address. About half an hour after that, his phone appeared to have moved to a different cell site, the cell site closest to Marie's home. Mr. Cameron's cell phone was in the area of Marie's house for quite some time, well, about half an hour anyway. But the last time he received any traffic on his cell phone was about 9:30 on the Saturday night. There was no activity from then until about 10 o'clock the next morning, when he appeared to be in the vicinity of Kaipoi, which was the same area that Marie's cell phone had been polling in that morning as well.
When we establish people may be a person of interest as to what has happened to someone, we start looking at their movements, and effectively you're trying to establish that the movements of the person that's missing in this scenario and the person of interest, their movements cross over. And his movements started to interlink with Marie Davis and close to her home address.
Police and ESR conduct a search of the house where Dean Cameron lives.
I understood from information given to me that Marie had actually been in the house the day prior to her disappearance.
This meant finding Marie's DNA would be expected and therefore easily explained in much of the house.
So we really concentrated on the bedroom of the suspect in the matter. We were primarily looking for bloodstaining present within the room. Nothing of any major significance. We didn't do any DNA analysis on anything from the room.
But police searching the garage find several pieces of rope and latex gloves similar to the rope and glove fragments found at the river.
It was like a coincidence, perhaps, but maybe there was a little bit more to that.
Investigators have identified Dean Cameron as a person of interest in the disappearance of 15-year-old Marie Davis. Latex gloves and sections of rope found at his house look to be similar to those found at the Waimakariri River. But are they a scientific match? Dr. Sally Corson of ESR's Physical Evidence Laboratory conducted the rope analysis, starting with the rope's construction.
So for this piece here, I've unwound the end, and you can see that it's got three strands, and they're twisted together in what's called a Z-twist.
Now, the Z-twist refers to the diagonal lines on the rope, which are like the letter Z.
And then each of those strands, the diagonal lines go the other way, as in the letter S, so that's an S-twist.
And is that a common way that rope is constructed?
Yes, it is. It's always the opposite. Otherwise, your rope would unravel. So we also can count the number of strands that there are.
Oh, that's very clear, isn't it? And there are probably, I can see, between 15 and 20 different strands there. And were there a similar amount of strands between the two ropes?
Yes, they were. We could not tell the ropes apart on any of the testing.
Chemical analysis identified all the rope samples were made from polypropylene and matched in colour. Even more support that they're exactly the same, but it's not conclusive evidence.
This type of rope is quite common, and so there would be other types of rope available on the New Zealand market that would also match these samples. It provides a link, but it's only a reasonably weak link because of how common the rope is.
Latex gloves are also widely available, and you'd think near impossible to tell apart. But with the help of some high-tech equipment, this is exactly what Dr. Corson aimed to do. Small pieces of the gloves are attached to metal stubs and placed inside an electron scanning machine at Auckland University's School of Engineering.
And what's actually happening in that chamber then?
So we've got an electron beam being fired at the latex sample, this area in the box here. Those atoms that are present are being excited, emitting X-rays, and the detector is measuring those X-rays.
So here we're measuring the elements that are on that periodic table.
That's correct. So for example, the calcium peak, those X-rays are emitted at about 3.9 electron volts. So at 3.9 electron volts, we know it's calcium. So sulfur here is about 2.4. And so because it's a 2.4, we know that peak is sulfur.
I'm amazed at how precise then the measurements you must be able to make are using this piece of kit.
It's a very high-tech instrument, and it is very accurate at detecting the elements that are in there. We've also had some smaller peaks come up. Potassium has come up for that peak, and potassium is something that you would expect to find in latex gloves.
Elemental composition differs between manufacturers and even between batches of gloves.
What did you find out?
At the suspect's address, we had four different types of latex gloves, but they were all different to what was found at the scene.
What was interesting was that out of the five gloves at the suspect's house, only two matched.
So a real variety of gloves at the suspect's house?
Yes, there was.
Police were very interested in Dean Cameron's movements as phone data placed him at Kaiapoi near the Waimakariri River on Sunday morning. He maintained he hadn't been at the river, nor had Marie ever been in his car. A potential breakthrough came when investigators found out some sections of the river were monitored by security cameras.
The inquiry did have highs and lows and was like, yes, this is great because we will hopefully see something. At that time, the cameras weren't running.
Dean Cameron's car was forensically examined for any evidential links to Marie.
We collected hairs, which we looked at. There was no visual blood staining on the inside and outside of the vehicle. We also did semen analysis in case there had been maybe some sexual event taking place in the car. No semen was recovered from the car. We also took swabs from any door handles or whatever that may have been touched by somebody. Did DNA analysis on a number of those. But overall, there was nothing really of significance from the vehicle.
No evidence of Marie was found in the car. But could the car be linked to the section of river where Marie's items had been found? Samples of debris were taken to see if they corresponded to the soil from the river scene. At GNS Science, these were broken down to release the material palynologist Dr. Dallas Mildenhall is most interested in, pollen.
And these are things we can't see, aren't they?
Oh, they're quite small. The largest pollen grains you could probably see an individual one by the naked eye, but most of them, no. Under the microscope here, I've got a slide from the Waimakariri River, and what you've got on screen there is Pinus. A very distinctive pollen type. It's quite large. That'd be about 60 to 80 microns across.
So that's less than a tenth of a millimetre.
Yes.
That's really, really, really small.
No, it's big. Most of the pollen that we look at is wind dispersed. But what we really want to find is something that is insect dispersed. Those plants disperse their pollen very locally. Most of the pollen will be deposited within a metre or so of the plant. Another way is to look at any sort of genetic abnormality, but something that is unusual.
Analysis requires identifying up to 3,000 pollen grains per sample. Databases include his own collection of some 20,000 pollen slides at GNS.
So what were the results?
From the Waimakariri River, the dominant pollen types were Pinus in particular, followed by the willow, followed by grass. Samples from the car contained those pollen types as well. There was nothing distinctive about the pollen from the river. Most of the pollen came from the weeds and from the trees that were growing there, and they grow all around Christchurch.
Was that disappointing?
We're always looking for a result, and when you don't get one, you are a bit disappointed. But that's science. And unless you look, you won't find the critical clue that may be there.
It was now 12 days since Marie went missing and 2 days since her bra, wallet and bedding from her home was discovered in the Waimakariri River.
For the first week, or even probably longer, I was in constant denial. I just kept thinking, no, she's somewhere else. She's got to be somewhere else. But it was only wishful thinking. I knew.
Searchers were faced with a vast and ever-changing area to cover.
The Waimak River has a huge catchment. It goes all the way up by Arthur's Pass, so it has lots of feeders coming into it, and it's quite braided. That is, it's quite broken. There's lots of little branches sort of coming down, and it changes as water comes down and it floods. It actually meanders quite a bit. Initially, I thought she would be reasonably close. I've recovered bodies in there before. When someone dies, they naturally sink to the bottom and they generally won't go that far. And what happens then, your body starts to decay or decompose, and what that does, that builds up a gas. And so the bacteria in the body creates that gas, and then after a few days, depending on the water temperature, then you'll float and start drifting down with the current. I arrived down there on the morning of the 17th. Then I got called by our comms saying that a motorist driving to work had seen something in the water. I had a boat, a jet boat, coming there. We hopped on that and went to check out the sighting of this object in the water. As we were coming back, that's where we actually saw Marie. And what that happened with her is she started to float down and she came to a braided section, that is where a higher section of river is starting to flow down into a lower section. So she became beached on that downward part. She was still submerged, only a little bit of her was out of the water, and she was quite hard to see because she was covered with a bit of silt as well.
So when we located the body, and from a policing point of view, we knew it was Marie, and she was naked. Most importantly is to let the family know before anyone else notifies the family. Obviously, it was overwhelming. The grief and the emotion around that is, you know, always difficult in anyone's police career to deal with. And you just know that Marie is no longer alive. Taking Marie's body from the river back to do a post-mortem, a forensic examination of her. Obviously, our hope then was that our science and our forensics experts were going to be able to assist us in holding someone accountable for what had happened to Marie.
The pathologist was not able to confirm the cause of death.
He could eliminate certain things, but not 100%. However, he could say it wasn't from natural causes.
Possible causes included neck compression, drowning couldn't be excluded. There was no sign of predation by eels or seagulls, which supported the view the body was wrapped up while in the water. As part of the post-mortem, swabs were taken from Marie's body.
My own personal view was it may be somewhat limited. The body's been submerged. We're going to get somewhat lucky to find anything that may be useful. I was looking at the slides prepared from the vaginal swabs. It suddenly became evident that there was semen present. You could see the sperm cells. And it's something you think, yeah, this could be quite interesting.
DNA expert Kat McGovern was called into Auckland's ESR to process the samples under what's termed ultra urgency.
Gary made notes about the number of spermatozoa that he'd seen on his slides. So those numbers were very low. They were present, but they were scored as a rank of one. So we knew that they were not the best of samples.
Viewing confirmed the minimal number, obvious, especially when seen alongside other cells contained on the slide.
It was a mixture of epithelial cells and spermatozoa. So epithelial cells are cells that line body orifices, such as the mouth or the genital tract, and they were the things that appeared green, like big green balloons, and then there were smaller oval-shaped red cells. Those were just the heads of the spermatozoa. The tails break off spermatozoa relatively quickly. So in this case, they wouldn't have been any tails present.
The minimal number wasn't the only issue. There was also the level of deterioration from being in the river for 12 days. Researching forensic archives for similar cases only emphasised how difficult the task would be.
There were a couple of papers that did look at recovering DNA from bodies that had been submerged. One was looking at recovering DNA from underneath fingernails. That was a body that had been in a bathtub for a matter of hours, not days. And one was a case in the US where a body had been in a slow-moving creek and they had recovered DNA from a bite mark on the neck, again, just a few hours. So nothing like the 12 days that was being looked at in this case.
Dedicated staff worked for over 2 days to establish whether obtaining a DNA profile from the spermatozoa was even possible.
I think actually seeing the mixed DNA profile with quite a lot of information there was quite satisfying given our expectation on the sample was so low to start with.
From that mixed DNA, a male profile was established.
Gave us a likelihood ratio of 5,000, which converts in words to very strong scientific support that that male DNA component had originated from Mr. Dean Cameron rather than male in the general New Zealand population.
Receiving that phone call that day was a bit of a yahoo moment, not only for me, but for all of the staff. It's just that satisfaction that you are going to be able to hold someone accountable for such a disgusting and sad scenario of taking someone's life.
The results from the bloodstains at the Davis home, which had been processed under a less urgent time frame, came through at virtually the same time. Small drops of blood in Marie's bedroom were hers, but in the study, bloodstains on the floor and on the armchair were strongly linked to Dean Cameron. After weeks of investigation, a case was building. Many regular users of the river reported seeing a silver sedan speeding along its banks on the Sunday morning Marie disappeared. Dean Cameron's car is a silver Mitsubishi.
The speed of the vehicle on the riverbank, and it's a stony road, dust going up, and people looked and obviously identified that's unusual.
Some of the bedding items were identified as being from Dean Cameron's home and others from the home of one of his friends. Witnesses also reported a dramatic change in his behaviour since Marie's disappearance.
He did speak to a friend on about day two of Marie's disappearance of him being a suspect for the investigation, when it very much at that time she was a missing person and there was no cause for him to have said that to someone. And his friends and family did describe his behaviour as being paranoid and quite unusual.
Dean Cameron had helped hand out flyers for missing Marie. He also attended her funeral. 4 days later, he was arrested and charged.
Dean Cameron went to Marie's home address and raped and murdered her. And took her body and dumped it in the Waimak River.
He'd overheard her talking about being home by herself on Saturday night. One of Marie's friends saw him listening from the kitchen.
Given that the phone call was made by Dean Cameron to Marie, whether he had said he was coming around, she did know him, it would indicate that she had let him into the house.
Much isn't known, including whether 15-year-old Marie fought back.
There was no signs of struggle, but there was the telltale sign of Dean Cameron's blood at that house.
Dean Cameron, aged 39, was convicted of the rape and murder of Marie Davis. At sentencing, it was revealed he'd previously been jailed for 4 years for sexual violation. He'd been released 9 months before he attacked Marie Davis. He was sentenced to preventative detention with a minimum parole period of 19 years.
Her birthday last month, she would have been 23. It's hard. I learned to cope with it. I don't think there will ever be a time where I won't ever not think about her.
When going through Marie's things, Janet found a list of careers Marie was considering. Among them, police detective and forensic scientist.
For me, it was quite a big case. A young missing girl whose body subsequently found, like homicide. It's a high-profile case, quite tough at times, a lot of demands from police, quite rightly. And it's always nice when something you do, you feel has some impact on the final, when it gets to court.
But still one of the more surprising results that I have seen. It's definitely memorable to recover spermatozoa from a body 12 days in a river.
There were times where it was just like, what has happened and who has been involved in this? You could draw conclusions, but we needed evidence. And I think for everyone that was involved, it was significant to hold someone accountable, but ultimately, we'd rather that it hadn't happened.
Marie Davis seemingly vanished into thin air, but after relentless police work and evidence provided by forensic science, her killer was identified and brought to justice.